It's a Monday Takeaway podcast for May 6th. I'm Tanzina Vega. First up, President Trump announces his pick to become the first permanent head of ICE since 2017.
The Trump administration is counting on being able to say, hey, this is a guy from the Obama administration, to sort of minimize the objection of Democrats.
We learn more about nominee Mark Morgan and what this pick could mean for the Trump administration's agenda on immigration. Also on the show, up to 7% of children in Puerto Rico have symptoms of post-traumatic stress after Hurricane Maria.
When it starts to rain, they freak out, or when the lights go out, they freak out. Those are all signs of potential traumatic stress that need to be evaluated.
Plus, we have the incredible Mexican singer Lila Downs on her new album.
It's really about singing songs that somehow release this anger, frustration, from my perspective, and I think a lot of people feel the same way.
All that in 30 minutes. Let's get going. President Trump said he wants to go in an even tougher direction on immigration enforcement, and Mark Morgan looks to be the man for the job.
If this president asked me to come up, I'd say yes in a heartbeat.
On Sunday, President Trump announced on Twitter that he'll be selecting Morgan, a former director of Customs and Border Protection, as his next head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. According to administration officials who spoke with The Washington Post, that news came as a surprise to ICE's current leadership. But the pick makes a lot of sense to anyone who's followed Morgan's recent appearances on Fox News.
And this isn't based on a political ideology. This is based on 30 years of law enforcement. And I know this border. The president's doing the right thing. He's right on this issue. And if he asked, I'd go and work for him in a heartbeat.
The president's announcement comes just 1 month after he withdrew the nomination of Ronald Vitiello to lead ICE. At the time, President Trump told reporters, quote, "We want to go in a tougher direction." Morgan will need to be confirmed by the Senate in order to officially serve as ICE director. But his nomination comes as the federal immigration system is facing scrutiny for the third death of a migrant child in just 6 months. Last week, 16-year-old Juan de Leon Gutierrez from Guatemala died while under the care of the Department of Health and Human Services. As director of ICE, Morgan will be tasked with carrying out the Trump administration's agenda to dissuade migrants from entering the United States. So far, President Trump's deterrent policies, though, don't seem to be working. The latest government totals on migrant apprehensions at the southern border have shown a significant increase from the same months last year.
I know this border. The president's doing the right thing. He's right on this issue.
I'm joined now by Bob Moore, a freelance reporter covering the border for The Washington Post and Texas Monthly. Thanks for coming back on The Takeaway, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off with Mark Morgan. Tell us again who Morgan is and what experience he's bringing to this role, if he is confirmed.
Mark Morgan is a longtime FBI official, including some tours of duty on the border region. He was the special agent in charge in the El Paso FBI office. In the Obama administration, he was the first person not from the ranks of the Border Patrol to be appointed chief of the Border Patrol. It was a really rocky tenure. The Border Patrol union opposed his appointment because the Obama administration basically appointed him to try to disrupt a culture at the Border Patrol. And so as soon as Trump took office in January of 2017, Morgan was forced to resign. But in the last few months, he has been a very vocal supporter of many of Trump's border initiatives. And I think, you know, obviously the Trump administration is counting on being able to say, hey, this is a guy from the Obama administration, to sort of minimize the objection of Democrats. Certainly in his appearances on Fox News and Fox Business in the last few months, Morgan has taken on this sort of tough role supporting the wall and supporting some of Trump's other initiatives, especially with Lou Dobbs, who sort of seems to be at times Trump's de facto DHS secretary.
Let's take a look at the broader implications here. ICE is also expected to start conducting DNA testing to see if migrants are actually related to the families that they are coming to the southern border with. I'm curious about this, Bob. Is this A, legal within international statutes of asylum and refugees? And if so, who is in charge of regulating this?
Certainly, you know, you want to make sure when kids are crossing the border that they're in safe circumstances. There may be steps short of DNA tests. There are obviously privacy and legality issues. The administration swears, for example, that it's going to dispose of the DNA records and not maintain them. But as with everything, you know, the administration is sort of regulating itself here and has made itself largely immune from congressional oversight.
Last week, the Trump administration also asked for $4.5 billion in emergency funding for migrants who were detained at the southern border. Where does that funding stand, and are Democrats likely to approve any of it?
There's two big buckets of money in there. One is for humanitarian relief, and the other is for detention. Democrats in the House in particular are likely to support the humanitarian efforts to, you know, provide comfort and safety to the migrants as they're being processed. They're less likely to approve of the other part, which is to essentially build more ICE detention space so that they can hold people who are coming across. So you'll have Democrats supporting one piece of this, but I don't see the Trump administration just signing off on a humanitarian aid package. They're going to want some additional enforcement in terms of detention beds. So we're probably just headed toward another standoff on border issues between the Democratic House and the Trump administration.
Bob, I mentioned earlier Juan de Leon Gutierrez, who's the 16-year-old Guatemalan boy who died last week while he was in the care of U.S. Health and Human Services. What do we know about his case?
We're still waiting to understand the cause of death. In some ways, this is similar to the two children who died in Border Patrol custody back in December, in that they got very ill and then died. It's particularly remindful of the case of Felipe Alonso Gomez, who died in Alamogordo, New Mexico, in that he got sick, was taken to a hospital, then discharged from the hospital and sent back into custody, and then got worse and then wound up dying. So that happened with both of these kids. And that raises some questions that I think bear looking at on what kind of pressure government agencies are putting on health professionals to quickly turn these kids around. There's certainly a cost for the government when they have kids at a hospital. And you also hear increasing complaints about how we're tying up resources by having government officials taking these kids to hospitals. So I think it bears looking at to see why this child, who was taken from McAllen, Texas, to Corpus Christi, which is, you know, a couple of hours away, so that he could be treated at Children's Hospital, then turned around and sent back into custody. I think that bears looking at.
Let's talk a little bit also about the Remain in Mexico policy. You've written extensively about this. Is it working?
It's part of a broader deterrent strategy, which is, you know, the entire Trump focus, and that's to, you know, make things as uncomfortable or as miserable for people crossing the border as they can, so that the word will eventually get out to Central America, don't come here. So I'm not sure how we gauge whether a policy is working or not. Certainly the Trump administration in the last couple of weeks has really ramped this policy up. As of 2 weeks ago, there had been about 300 to 400 cases of people in El Paso who'd been returned to Ciudad Juarez across the border to wait while their asylum cases were heard. And in the past 2 weeks, that jumped up real quickly to 1,600. So you're seeing this real pressure being brought in Juarez that's really straining the social services available there. We are seeing an increased number of people not showing up to their first hearing after they're supposed to come back from Juarez into the United States. That may be an indication that people are giving up their cases and going home because they don't want to be stuck in Juarez, which is a very dangerous city, and they can't work there. And I think that's part of the underlying strategy that the administration is employing with this policy, is to have people essentially abandon their asylum claims because it's too difficult to navigate through. We also know that people who are being sent back to Mexico now, at least in El Paso, are being given court dates for October. So they're looking at a wait of at least 5 months in Mexico before they can even have their first hearing in U.S. immigration court. So this really bears watching for a couple of reasons. One, you have a potential humanitarian crisis developing in these northern Mexico border cities. And secondly, we're still waiting on the Ninth Court of Appeals to rule on a request for an injunction that would temporarily block this policy. That's been pending for several weeks before the Ninth Court, and they haven't acted yet.
And what about Mexico in all of this? I mean, to say that in Juarez and other cities, there will be a backlog of migrants waiting for their day in U.S. court. How is Mexico faring here?
The official position from the Mexican government is that this is a unilateral action by the United States. But of course, there's really no such thing on the border. And so there's a wink and a nod agreement between the two national governments, where President López Obrador in Mexico is accepting of this policy now. But at the local level in the communities that are taking on these migrants, there's a lot of resistance. It's straining resources, but it's also, the United States is not the only country with nationalistic impulses. And so you're starting to see a backlash in these border communities against these migrants. People saying things like, oh, you're coming to take away our jobs. And also these migrants are at great risk in these border communities because of their accents, the way they dress, the fact that they're kept in shelters. They're really easy prey for criminal organizations. And so one of the things that's come out in immigration courts as these people come back for their first hearings is that they're being subjected to kidnappings, robberies, assaults, a couple of examples of attempted sexual assaults, child snatching. So Mexico's not going to tolerate this forever. And so that bears watching as well.
And of course, just to round out the conversation here, Bob, last week, the Trump administration released a memo asking for rule changes to the asylum process. What are these new rule changes and how far have they gotten?
They're all sort of proposed rules right now, and so they have to go through the rulemaking process, and then they'll almost certainly be subject to legal challenges. But again, all of this is part of a broader package of deterrence efforts where the administration just believes that if they make it inconvenient or uncomfortable or more difficult for people to apply for asylum, then the word will eventually get back to Central America and people won't come in the numbers that we're seeing now. The point that all of that misses, of course, is that it underestimates the conditions in the home countries that are essentially forcing people to migrate right now. And it's very difficult to see what the United States could do that would be so uncomfortable or so punitive to migrants that they wouldn't keep coming. Everything the administration has done on the deterrence front so far has failed to stem this tide. I do think we'll probably see a slowdown in the next couple of months, which is somewhat traditional as the weather warms up, and that may give the president some comfort that things are working. But I think it would probably be a false sense of comfort. And then as temperatures drop in the fall, we might start to see the return of the migratory trend. So this is a story for the long haul, for sure.
Bob Moore is a freelance reporter covering the border for The Washington Post and Texas Monthly. Bob, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you for having me again today.
So if you tune into the show tomorrow, things are going to sound a little different. And that's because we're going to be broadcasting in front of a live studio audience here in New York City. It's the one-year anniversary of my very first broadcast on The Takeaway. And if you're here in New York, you can join our celebration. Join us at the Green Space here at WNYC Studios tomorrow, May 7th at 9 a.m. Eastern. And if you're not in New York, don't worry. You can still listen on air or online. Or you can check out the live stream. I've got a cast of amazing thinkers and writers and performers joining me for a conversation about the three big gaps I see in our society today: the wealth gap, the truth gap, and the empathy gap. You'll hear from The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb, Desus and Mero writer and comedian Ziwe Fumido, and Susan Shearer from The Marshall Project, and others. That's tomorrow on The Takeaway. Por quererte, por amarte, por desearte. Lila Downs is one of Mexico's most well-known singer-songwriters. When the six-time Grammy Award winner is not making music, Lila is an activist for women, indigenous people in Mexico, and human rights. And when it comes to speaking truth to power, she doesn't hold back. That's why the title of her newest album, released last Friday, is so fitting. Al Chile.
Al Chile is a phrase that it's not really a phrase, it's a couple words, that basically refers to being honest and telling it like it is.
When Lila joined me to talk about her new music and her politics, I asked her why she turned to Chile for this album.
It's actually inspired by Chile and this beautiful spice that makes us suffer, makes us sweat, but also gives us a lot of inspiration through food and makes us happy. And we have a very special relationship in Mexico with Chile, but I venture to say in all of Latin America, it's a spice that flavors our lives.
Con chile verde bien rebanado, chile chilhuacle puro sabor, y de morita y de habanero, ese provoca mucho sudor. Con chile verde bien rebanado, chile chilhuacle puro sabor.
When you think about how the president, President Trump, or other politicians in the United States look at the Latino population, particularly when we talk about Mexicans, how do you feel that they're portrayed?
I think that there's a lot of ignorance on both sides. I think actually there's a lot of misunderstanding. And that's why I think culture is a great way to, open those windows for people to really learn more about different cultures and traditions. And that's why it's important to know about things like Chile, because I think that it affects identity and pride, and also it makes us smile. And I always look for things that make us happy when things are getting tense.
Speaking of things getting tense, there have been some pretty difficult political moments, in particular this past year. And I'm thinking about the family separation crisis we saw at the border. You have a song on your album, Clandestino, that is very critical of the Trump administration's actions. Tell us about this song.
Yeah, it's actually a cover song. It's a Manu Chao song that was very popular back in the 90s when there was another immigration crisis, I think we could call it. And I think that today the same things are happening, but maybe in a bigger level. It's about the children. I think that when I saw these videos about the children being locked into these detention centers and in such a sad condition, I just couldn't believe that we as a society could permit this to happen. So it's really about singing songs that somehow release this anger, frustration from my perspective. And I think a lot of people feel the same way.
In terms of your own personal history, you grew up in Mexico and the United States. You were sort of going back and forth as you grew up. How does that personal history inform your music, particularly with this issue of immigration and migration more broadly?
When I was a child, I really denied my Latin and indigenous heritage because I identified much more with the Anglo background. My father was an Anglo-American. But then there came a time of crisis for me where I felt like I was denying myself. So this made me want to study our history in Latin America a lot more, and that's why I ended up studying anthropology. And I still continue to look at music that way, you know, finding issues and subjects where we can learn more about them and also perform them and sing about them and somehow express and teach people the cultural diversity that we have in Latin America and how rich it is, you know.
And particularly when we think about that cultural diversity, I think that often, and when we think about who lives in Mexico, there's often very limited understanding of the languages that are spoken, of the different cultural backgrounds. One of the songs in on your latest album is La Llorona, which is a very well-known song in Mexico. But you don't sing it in Spanish. You sing it in Zapoteco, which is an indigenous language from Oaxaca in southern Mexico.
This is a song that traditionally is sung in Zapoteco, in the Isthmus. This album is accompanied by a documentary where we went to this community and recorded the Zapotec children playing on this particular track. It's been important for me to sing in the indigenous languages because they were prohibited to be spoken in my mother's generation and for many generations after that. So, you know, talking to teachers and people who are involved in designing language and poetry and different kinds of expressions in indigenous languages, I think there is preoccupation about these languages surviving. In some cases, they do have probably growing numbers, but most of them are in danger of disappearing. So if there is a way to support these languages, I am very happy to do it because they are so beautiful musically. My mother is Mixtec, and she translated Los Caminos de la Vida, which is this classic Colombian cumbia. She did a version in Mixtec as well.
I want to talk a little bit about the country itself, Mexico, what's happening politically there. Let's talk a little bit about Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who essentially was seen as really bringing change to Mexico. And I was just talking to one of our producers here who has family from that country. And we were just thinking, has he really done that? I mean, it's been a couple months. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that it's a change for Mexico. I think it's taking a long time to reorganize certain things. Of course, we all wish that we could be perfect and and everything would change quickly, especially the violence. We're hoping that things become as they were in the past, where there wasn't that much violence. But I think that we need to require this of him. But at the same time, I think that it's all up to us as well. It's a little of both. I think one of his main gestures is to accept indigenous people and look at them or focus on indigenous peoples. And I think it's going to take a while to work on this. It's not an easy thing to just expect it to change, you know, in a few months or even in a few years. I think these are problems that have complicated solutions.
Lila Downs is a Grammy Award-winning Mexican singer-songwriter. Her newest album, Al Chile, is out now. Lila, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, you, podcast person. Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
According to a government report last year, Hurricane Maria took a $43 billion toll on Puerto Rico's economy. The federal government has been unwilling to provide a comprehensive aid package, and when Puerto Rico's food stamp program was forced to cut benefits back in March, Congress couldn't work out a deal to provide funding, and the legislation has continued to stall. But lost in the political back and forth are the children on the island, those who have endured the lingering effects of a disaster that has impacted nearly every aspect of their lives. And now a new study is pointing to lasting signs of trauma. Rosara Orengo Aguayo is an assistant professor and clinical psychologist at the National Crime Victims Research and Treatment Center at the Medical University of South Carolina, and she joins me now to discuss her findings. Rosara, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So based on your research, 7% of children in Puerto Rico have shown post-traumatic stress disorder related to Hurricane Maria. First of all, what are the symptoms the children were showing?
We actually work very closely with teachers, pediatricians to identify the following signs. If you see a child that normally would be engaging with other children, socializing, gets good grades, and all of a sudden starts getting worse grades, isolates, or becomes aggressive, that might be a potential sign. You might also see children that are telling you that they can't sleep or that look really groggy all the time, and that wasn't normal for them. That's another potential sign. And finally, we have children who start telling you that they think a lot about the hurricane or the scary thing that happens, or when it starts to rain, they freak out, or when the lights go out, they freak out. Those are all signs of potential traumatic stress that need to be evaluated.
Can you remind us what these children experienced that led to them experiencing PTSD?
So all of my family and my husband's family is still in Puerto Rico, and I'm from Puerto Rico. So we really saw in the United States mainland a live depiction of the destruction via Facebook, via Twitter. And really what we're talking about is roofs being blown up, flooding, flash flooding everywhere in the island. All of the electricity poles in the island fell down. We're talking about landslides. And what people remember the most, and children will tell you, is this loud, unbearable noise that felt like the entire house was just going to fly away.
Tell me how you went about the study. What was the methodology?
So a few days after Maria impacted the island, some of my great colleagues who are now postdoctoral fellows at MIT and Harvard were in Puerto Rico, and they went to Command Central, where all the heads of state met in the San Juan area, and said, how can we help? And there they ran into the ex-secretary of the Puerto Rico Department of Education, and the secretary said, we need trauma experts. So my colleagues WhatsApp me, and we started via spotty Wi-Fi, Google Docs, WhatsApp, a plan to help children of Puerto Rico recover. And this study came about because we believe in partnerships, and the Puerto Rico Department of Education needed a needs assessment. They wanted to understand what children were going through. So we consulted with national experts, came up with the evidence-based standard of surveys after a hurricane. And then the Puerto Rico Department of Education, with the help of volunteer teachers and administrators, gave this to over 96,000 public school students in the island.
What are the differences in how children experience PTSD compared to adults?
Children are uniquely vulnerable to trauma. Think about it. Children depend not only on themselves, but on adults. So not only did they have a very difficult life event where they felt like their life might have been in danger, most children experience at least 3 to 8 months without electricity, access to portable water, schools had not opened. And on top of that, they're surrounded by adults who themselves have experienced trauma, who may be dysregulated, who may be anxious, lost their jobs. So their entire social support network is impacted. And this often aggravates symptoms for children.
What are some of the long-term effects of this trauma if it goes untreated?
We're talking about children, first of all, having mental health impacts. So, for example, we know that children with PTSD might go on also to develop depression, anxiety. Their grades might suffer because they can't concentrate in class, because their mind is always thinking about the bad things that can happen. Then this, in turn, can impact their ability to relate to other children and adults. And if this goes untreated, frankly, we're talking about potential involvement in substance use, having suicidal ideation, and eventually this can impact their adult life in terms of achieving a healthy life.
What types of treatment are currently available for Puerto Rican children who are experiencing PTSD, and where are the gaps?
We know from the literature and decades of study that the evidence-based treatment for trauma in kids is called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, or its school equivalent, cognitive behavioral intervention for trauma in school, CBITS. And unfortunately, in Puerto Rico, just as in many areas of the United States, we have what we call a professional shortage area in mental health, meaning that the majority of professionals that have training in evidence-based psychotherapy, such as TFCBT, are located near the capital in San Juan and the metropolitan districts. So we're talking about more than 90% of the island doesn't have access to evidence-based treatments. And our team specifically has been working with the Puerto Rico Department of Education, the University Carlos Albizu in San Juan in Mayagüez, and the University of Puerto Rico in Río Piedras Ciencias Médicas to train providers in these evidence-based treatments.
What exactly is the treatment that these children can get?
This, when we're talking about trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, we're talking about an evidence-based treatment, usually over 12 to 18 sessions individually with the patient and in parallel with the caregiver, where we're teaching specific skills that we know work, such as identifying their emotions, labeling them, identifying difficult thoughts and how we can think about them in a more helpful way, providing coping skills such as relaxation and mindfulness skills, and also what we call exposure. So whenever something scary happens, we tend to avoid it, and that actually makes the problem worse. So in a controlled, safe, professional way, we help students tell their stories about the trauma and think about it in a way that makes them feel safer and like they overcame it.
Rosara Orengo Aguayo is assistant professor and clinical psychologist at the Medical University of South Carolina. Rosara, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.